I'll be turning in your Bible to Psalm 46. As we continue this evening looking at some of the Psalms of Praise. We've looked at Psalm 8. That dealt mainly with praise for God's creation, and then Psalm 19 last week that began with creation and then built to God's revealed Word, and then God even showing His power through man and how He had elevated man to a position of a special position of dominion within His creation. This psalm this evening is still a psalm of praise, but it's quite a bit different in its focus. A mighty fortress is our God. Praising God for the fact that He is the refuge, the strength and refuge that we can always go to. Whatever's going on in this world, whatever Satan is throwing at us, that God is still in control. Selected this particular psalm for a couple of reasons. One, it's a psalm of the sons of Korah, if you notice in the title. Most of the ones we've looked at so far, I think actually all the ones we've looked at so far, have been Psalms of David. And also, this psalm seems to have been written during a time of a significant national crisis. And so it gives us the opportunity to look into how people of faith dealt with those difficult times that came in life. And we'll talk in just a moment about what that crisis, I believe, was that they were going through. But if you look at, the heading of the psalm, and again, those are from the original manuscripts, to the chief musician, a psalm of the sons of Korah, a song for Alamoth. And so it's addressed to the chief musicians, those would be the leaders of the choruses for the temple. And it tells us three different characteristics about the psalm. One, that it belongs to the sons of Korah. That could mean one of two things. It could mean that it was written by one of them. That's probably what it means. Or it could mean that it was part of the collection used by the sons of Korah. Not sure exactly which of those it might be. But then it also says, for Alamoth. Alamoth is word for damsels, young maidens. And so that may suggest that this had a soprano or a female voices that were used in the singing of this particular psalm. And it also points out the fact that it is a song. Well, it's a song is kind of the same thing. But a song is a general term that was used in Scripture to identify both secular as well as sacred songs. It's used some 30 times in the titles of these various psalms that are identified particularly as songs. But this is a very beautiful psalm showing the confidence that we have in God. It tells of the disturbed and troubled believer in God who's maybe very down in a very difficult situation, that regardless of what may happen in the world, that he or she can trust in the protection and the peace of God. That God is that mighty fortress, that bulwark there. And so we can understand what Martin Luther, if you noticed in the song that we just sang, and I asked Joe to lead that, if you would, before the because that is a song, a mighty fortress that's based upon this particular psalm. It was written by Martin Luther. If you probably don't always look, see who they're written by, but that particular one is written by Martin Luther, so it's a fairly old song. But he did write that as he read from Psalm 46, the basis of that. Well, the background of this particular psalm is believed to be the God's miraculous deliverance of Jerusalem from the wicked Assyrian king Sennacherib. And we read about that particular account in 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19, 2 Chronicles 32 and also the prophet Isaiah, chapters 36 and 37. The psalm doesn't provide extensive evidence that it's tied to that, but there are some hints there, and most scholars believe that is the occasion probably of that writing. Doesn't really affect our understanding of the writing a whole lot one way or the other. But if that is indeed the case, we remember that story. Hezekiah, the king of Judah, had tried to throw off his dependence upon Assyria, and Assyria was the dominant world power at that particular time. And when he did that, and Sennacherib sent his army to beat him into submission, basically, was what they were going to do. And as the Assyrian king made his way across Judah, he destroyed some 46 walled, fortified cities before he got to Jerusalem. And so he's already gave Judah as a whole a pretty good whipping before he gets to the city of Jerusalem itself. Apparently, he had agreed to spare Jerusalem if Hezekiah would submit to his rule and would express that submission by paying tribute to him once again. They had done that in the past, but Hezekiah has stopped doing that. But Hezekiah refused to do that. He's going to put his trust in God instead of in this Assyrian king. Well, Sennacherib sends his forces to Jerusalem. He's demanding an immediate surrender from Hezekiah and the Israelites and Judah. And in a letter that he sent to Hezekiah, Sennacherib blasphemously denied the ability of Yahweh, of Jehovah God, to deliver Jerusalem from his power. Isaiah records that in Isaiah 37, verses 9 through 13. Well, Hezekiah took Sennacherib's letter, and he took it into the temple, and he laid it out before the Lord, and he appealed to the Lord to show him what to do. Isaiah 37, 14 through 20. And in response then, God sent his prophet Isaiah, and he prophesied that Sennacherib would be humbled and sent home. 2 Kings 19, 20 through 34, and Isaiah 37, 21 through 35. Well, Sennacherib's soldiers were camped just outside of Jerusalem. They've made it all the way to Jerusalem. They're right outside the wall. They're intending to take over the city the next morning. A huge army. The Assyrians, again, the most capable army of the time. But amazingly, when the morning came, 185,000 of Sennacherib's men lay dead. We read that in 2 Kings 19:35 and Isaiah 37, verse 36. Well, during the night, a sudden and mysterious visitation of death had gone through that camp, courtesy of the Lord, and had killed all those people. So humiliated by what had happened, the Assyrian forces, of course, what was left of them, packed up and went home, leaving Jerusalem untouched. A victory to that extent certainly is very dramatic. A very persuasive, a very visible illustration of how God comes to the rescue of His own. And again, it's believed that it was shortly after that remarkable event that the words of this particular psalm are penned. But as the people of Jerusalem get up that next morning and they look out and they see what's happened, they're expecting at least, worst case, that here's going to come the Assyrians over the walls that next morning. Instead, they see all these dead, and so there's shouts of thanksgiving, of rejoicing, and certainly left a very lasting impression upon the minds of the people of Judah. Well, even if this psalm is not written about that particular historical event, and we don't know again for sure if it is or not, Sennacherib's encounter stands as a vivid illustration, at the very least, of kind of what is encompassed within this particular psalm and the God, the refuge, and the strength that we have in the Lord. The psalm presents three comforting promises about life. There's three stanzas. Again, it is a psalm. Each of them ends with Selah. Selah is a musical dictation that's in it. that is kind of like a rest within our music. It's a pause. And so each time you see Selah, it's a time to pause and contemplate and think about what was just said before you move on. And I kind of wish we had those in the New Testament sometime where we'd pause and think a little bit before we just rush on maybe to the next thing. You know, life has its ups and downs. We all go through difficult times. We enjoy the ups, but sometimes the downs shatter us. The downs are very difficult. And so this psalm tells us what the believer needs to know about the downside of life, about the tough times of life. And if our whole life is all wrapped up in this life, then we're going to be very disappointed. But if it's in the Lord, if our we're leaning and our strength is within the Lord, then we can make it through those things. And so first of all, the first section, we might say turmoil all around. The turmoils of this life. It says beginning in verse 1, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth is removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. Selah. And so, God is both His people's defense, we might say, and offense. He's their refuge and their strength. He's the strength to go to battle. He's the refuge that they can come into for security. God is our refuge and strength. So in times of adversity, He can sustain His people internally by being their spiritual strength. He can also protect them externally by being their divine refuge or stronghold, as it is in some of the translations. It says He will be a very present help. The Hebrew phrase there literally means He is found swiftly. He is found abundantly. He's always there. He's always there for His people. He's accessible, fully and immediately accessible. In times of grave danger, He's there. We can rely on Him. We can find Him. And so God's people have nothing to fear regardless of what may happen. God will always be more than sufficient for any of their trials. God can take care of His people. As we move into verse 2, we see that even in the most violent disasters, that God will be a gracious, almighty help to those who trust in Him. He says, therefore, we will not fear. The confidence can be theirs, though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. He's talking there symbolically, obviously. He's talking about the trials of life. The promise is sure. Though the very most reliable, the strongest material entities that we see, the earth and the mountains, though they melt and they crumble into the sea and they disappear, as life just begins, seems like it's just caving in on us from every direction, the Lord is a very present help. He's always there for us. Verse 3, we see that nothing that happens to the sea, the land, the mountains, should shake our faith in God. Nothing that happens in this world should shake us to that degree. It says, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. You know, again, you just look around and it just seems like your world is imploding. We've probably all been there at times. And we look to God. You know, if the seas should rush out of their boundaries and the mountains bellow forth with volcanoes and earthquakes and all kinds of disasters, we can rest our heart without anxiety in the kind superintendence or control that God has. God is still in charge. God is still the King. He still reigns on His throne in heaven. Implied in this first stanza is the truth that individually and collectively, God's people will experience turmoil in the world. Well, we can't escape the negative things of this world. This world is a world that's full of sin. It's full of the effects of worldliness and Satan. And there's some bad things going on in this world. We can't escape those. Those are a reality. part of the earthly living is doing battle with the violent forces of hardship and struggle and death and all of the things that go with this life. And the earth at times may seem to be crumbling under our feet. The whole world may seem to be breaking open and falling upon us. And then sometimes there's even the internal turmoil, things that we're struggling with on the inside. All seems to be crushing down sometime. But whether that's the sweeping turbulences of the visible, the catastrophic, the things that are coming from the outside, or whether the things that are taking place secretly in the soul, God will sustain His people. God is our refuge. God is our strength. This fact is the divinely promised assurance that belongs to anyone who trusts in God. That God is still in control. We need to always remember that, no matter what this life may throw at us. And then at the end of verse 3 again, we have that Selah. Pause and think about it. Pause and contemplate what these first three verses say. And then it goes on into the next stanza, and we might say God is our only real refuge. The only real refuge or stronghold again. Verse 4 says, there is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her, she shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered His voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. So verse 4, we see that surrounded by this troubled world, this unpredictable world that's around about us, God's people are set apart as His own possession, the object of His tender and loving care. It says, there is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. And God's people have no reason to fear, only reason to be glad. We don't have to be a fearful people. Why? Because God is among us. God is with us. His presence provides the highest security and the very highest joy. God has assigned a river, it says, to flow through the city of God where the holy place is. The words "there is" there in the text in most translations is added by the translators, not in the original Hebrew. It's added for the sake of clarity. Jerusalem, of course, the analogy here: Jerusalem, the physical city of Jerusalem, the place of God. Jerusalem is the city of God. In this day, it was certainly the city of God in a very real sense, the holy place. Was within that city, that place which belonged to the Most High, the Supreme God, the one and the only God. And we're not to think, of course, of that river. Again, he's talking symbolically. He's not talking about a literal river flowing through the physical city of Jerusalem. But it's metaphorical. It's suggesting peace and tranquility represented by rivers that comes to us flowing out of the hand of God. And so the figurative river rushes out in various streams, spreading God's calm throughout His city to the people of His choosing, to people in an arid land. Flowing water is the supreme figure of abundance and provision. You know, water, something we take for granted as long as we have it, and when you don't have it, it becomes the most precious resource you have. And certainly, symbolic here of abundance, provision given by God. God's great comfort branches out to all the different areas of turmoil for His people. The branch separates into various streams as it goes out and comforts the people. Verse 5, we see that we can be assured that His people will never fall. God is in the midst of her, she shall not be moved. You know, God's people will always be aware of His readiness to help them. we should always remember, again, who's on the throne? It's God. And so the city of God, which contained the holy place and the place of the Most High, is threatened by these nations round about, but they're not to be dismayed by those threats. Because again, God is in charge. That city can calmly trust in the protection of the God who is in her midst. God's presence means God's protection. So God will be ever ready to deal with any enemy that approaches His people. It says God shall help her just at the break of dawn. God is there. God is our refuge. God is our strength. God is there to help. The phrase "just at the break of dawn" literally means to the turning of the morning. Again, it could have reference here to these Assyrians, and you know they get up in the morning, and here's all of these dead Assyrians that had planned on attacking Jerusalem and overrunning the walls that day, but instead 185,000 dead. I don't know how many was in that army to begin with, but that's an awful lot of dead people. It could have direct reference to that. It could just be more of a general reference to the fact that God's promise that God would not allow His people to suffer for a long period of time. Even though there may be suffering metaphorically through the night for a period of time, and we know there are periods of suffering in this life, but God will always come at the break of dawn. God always comes in time, and God takes care of it. Verse 6, we see that nations may roar against God's people like angry waves of the sea tossed about. You know, again, part of that turmoil of life may come from other nations, even from within our own nation. It says the nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered His voice, the earth melted. And so the kingdoms were moved. The kingdoms tottered, the New American Standard has it, in the sense that they were rising and falling. You've got, throughout this time of history, these nations are just kind of coming and going. You know, one will rise to power and they stay on top for a while and they're top dog, and then some bigger dog comes along and whips them, and they kind of go off into oblivion, and another one rises up. And so the kingdoms being invaded are falling. The kingdoms that are doing the conquering, they're excelling. But it's always in flux. It's always changing. People don't know really what they can count on if they're trying to count on a nation, because what's here today might not be here tomorrow. And so commotion and upheaval characterize the nations of the world. That's been true pretty much throughout time. True even today, isn't it? You know, sometimes we get maybe a little too wrapped up in our own nation even. And, you know, I know we're all concerned about the election that's coming. And, you know, come what may, whether Hillary wins or Trump wins, or somebody we don't even know about wins, or Obama refuses to leave the White House, it's all going to be okay because the King is still on His throne. The Lord is still in heaven. And it'll be okay. He's our strength. He's our refuge. And so in the midst of such national disturbances, it says God spoke and the earth melted. Here's all these nations fighting for priority. But God's still in control. When God speaks, they all simply melt away. At His word, the fluctuations of the earth, as wide and violent as they are, they pass away. They're not the things that are important. The raging world becomes calm for the people of God. Again, it might not be calm in the physical sense, but it can be calm for the people of God, because those are the people that have God's protection. Verse 7, we see that the refrain of this verse pictures God as the sovereign ruler of the universe. Again, He is the one in charge. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. He is the Almighty One. The God of Jacob, the God of the nation of Israel. He is the Lord of hosts. To have Him on one side is to have a refuge, to have a stronghold, which cannot be broken into or overthrown by any force or any enemy on earth. Again, He says, Selah. Selah. Pause and reflect on this. Pause and think about it, what has just been said. And then the last few verses, the last section, He is our refuge. Verses 8 through 11. Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolation in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bows and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. So in verse 8, we see in light of who God is, a special appeal is made to observe the works that God has made. Come, behold the works of the Lord who has made desolations in the earth. The reader of the psalm and the nations round about are urged to look at what God has done. Consider the works that God has done, to learn valuable lessons as we view the wonders of what God has done. Verse 9, we see that God has defeated the enemies of His people. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow. He cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. God has overthrown nations. He's brought them to desolation. He's ended the attack of heathen nations upon His people by breaking the bow, breaking the spear, burning their chariots, the weapons of war is what's being described there. God can take those just like He can kill 185,000 in an army in one night. He can take all the weapons of war and destroy them if He so chooses. There's no nation that has any power to stand against God and God's ways. And so the writer, again, may have been alluding to the great Assyrian army. The earth at that time knew no greater war machine than the army of Sennacherib, the king who was threatening Jerusalem. He was the greatest war machine there was. His forces were feared throughout the nation, but God routed him very decisively in one night while they were all sleeping. In verse 10, we see that because of His promises and His ability to keep them, God's people are told to relax. You know, again, we get all uptight about the things of this world, don't we? We worry and we sweat and we lose sleep. God's saying, relax. Notice what it says, be still. Be still and know that I am God. Don't forget who I am. Don't forget who's really in charge. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. Oh, but we've got some very powerful people that stand up and won't acknowledge God, don't we? But God can take them out in a heartbeat. God will be exalted. And we can command our spirits to be calm and to be unafraid. That's what He says, be still. You know, don't worry about it. Turn it over to God. God will not be overthrown by any person, by any nation, by any force on this earth. God is still the King of Kings, and He will be exalted among the nations. So anyone who chooses can see that God is the true and the living God. The whole earth can observe that only God could have brought about what happened outside the walls of Jerusalem. 185,000 men out of an army don't just lay down one night and all die before the next morning without God's hand being in that. Very obvious to anyone who's honest and looks at it. And so complete, so miraculous, so decisive was this defense of Jerusalem that no one with an honest heart could fail to recognize that this was God, that there's a divine hand behind what happened here. Anybody can see that there is no other God other than Israel's God, Jehovah God. Verse 11, the writer closes the psalm with the same refrain that he used in verse 7. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. You know, the greatest news of all is that the Lord of hosts, the Almighty One, is with us. Just stop. Shiloh. Or Selah, and let that sink in a minute. God, the Lord of hosts, is with us. If we are His people, He is with us. The God of Israel, the true and the living God, is with us in times of trouble. And that being true, there's no enemy that's too strong for Him to overcome. There's no disaster that's too cataclysmic for Him to stop. There's no danger that's too vicious for Him to prevent. And then He points out once again, the God of Jacob. The God of Jacob has shown Himself to be stronger than the whole earth. The nations of the earth, they must learn that their strength cannot compare to His. They're fighting a losing battle if they fight against the Lord. They'll lose every time. God's people never need to be fearful. They never need to fear danger, because God is our refuge. God is our stronghold. And again, Selah. Selah, pause and think about what's been said. You know, all recognize this psalm as a majestic celebration of the believer's strength, security in God. We praise God. It is, as we said, a song of praise. There are three truths that confront us in the psalm. One is, in this world we will have turmoil. You know, he doesn't say that He's going to exempt His people from turmoil in some way. Turmoil is presented as a reality, a part of life that has to be dealt with. And it's a part of life that causes people a lot of trouble sometimes. In fact, one of the arguments that is very often made against the existence of God, or at least a benevolent God, is pain and suffering and trouble that come. Wednesday night we announced a debate that's going to take place on Tuesday evening between this atheist, Alexander Rosenberg, and Brother Ralph Gilmore. And the atheist, Alexander Rosenberg, affirms this statement: "Since I know that there is vast human and animal suffering, I know that a benevolent, omnipotent God does not exist." So a lot of people look at that turmoil, the reality of life, and write God off. Brother Gilmore, he affirms, he says, the use of suffering as a moral criticism against God implies the absolute moral law of God. Therefore, God exists. He doesn't deny pain and suffering. He doesn't deny turmoil. You know, sometimes hardships will come very quickly. They'll come without much fanfare, so to speak. Sometimes they come with loud screams of upheaval and almost volcanic-like explosions that are going on in our life. And when those trials come, we need to remember that God is near. He is accessible. He's an ever-present God. He's ever ready to assist us. He is our strength and our refuge. Secondly, the second truth that confronts us is God is our only refuge. There is no other refuge. There is no other place we can go that is strong enough, that is accessible enough, that's large enough to provide the stronghold that all of God's people must have. There's no other option for a refuge to flee to other than God. And thirdly, we see that we must choose for Him to be our refuge. It's a choice. We don't have to go to the refuge, but we choose. God will be our refuge if we choose Him to be. His help is available, but He's not going to force Himself on us. And that's what we see as we look at the history of Israel, isn't it? So often, even though He was always there as a refuge and strength, so often they ignored His refuge and strength and went some other direction. And when they did, He didn't force Himself on them. He allowed them to go into captivity to various nations and so forth because they did not choose to go to Him. But God alone is our protection from the hardships, the difficulties of life. He is our refuge, our strength. We can't find real power and peace in political strength. We can't find it in well-armed military forces, in the ingenuity of men, in any kind of human shelter, anything that man comes up with. We rest in God, the mighty fortress. A mighty fortress is our God. What a beautiful psalm of praise for who God is. And we need to always be mindful. Again, I think we kind of lose sight sometime and we put a little too much faith in our government and our own strength and so forth. And remember that God is that refuge. God is our strength. The lesson's yours. If anyone here this evening needs to respond to the Lord's invitation, whether to put on your Lord in baptism or whether we need your brothers and sisters to pray with you and for you, or whatever need you might have, if you'd let it be known as we stand and sing.